Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Active cases of COVID-19 continue to rise across the state. Hospitalizations have risen as well, and with that, social media rumors have also taken new flight. Since the first cases of the contagion were confirmed in South Dakota, SDPB has brought you weekly and often daily updates on what we know about the virus and how to keep yourself and your family safe. And we've done that largely because people like Dr. Shankar Kura with Monument Health, he's Vice President of Medical Affairs, continue to show up for us week after week and answer some of those questions and dispel those myths. And Dr. Kura is with us again today. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori.
Let's touch base on some of the myths or misinformation or new information. And I think it's important to always go back to some of these things because since the beginning of this, we've learned new things about this virus, on a weekly, sometimes daily basis. And all that I think you said science by social media or science by press noise can get confusing. So this is always a time to kind of cut through all that noise and go right to the experts. And let's talk about this concept of herd immunity and the idea that at some point enough of us will simply get this virus to where it will not matter. It is a novel coronavirus that so many people had never been exposed to before. Mm-hmm. So help us get our minds around whether or not herd immunity is actually a thing, and what that means for us as we continue to fight this disease.
Lori, thank you for having me on your show. Great topic to start with. I think this one is very misunderstood. If you're not an epidemiologist, if you don't have the background, and what on the surface appears a very simple phrase, herd immunity, is a lot more complicated and definitely hard to understand without at least a background. So let me make an attempt to make this understandable. What we're talking about when we say herd immunity is if you have 100 people in a gathering and you had only 5 people that had ever been exposed, you're talking about 95 people being susceptible to the infection. So if one of those 95 had the disease, it would spread according to the R-naught. So in the case of measles, one individual can infect up to 14 to 15 others. In the case of SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19, the disease that this new SARS number 2 virus does, it spreads to roughly 2.5, even up to 3, depending on other factors that influence the R-naught. So if it's crowded space, no circulation, et cetera, with no barriers. So what we're seeing is if you have a population of 70 people out of the 100 all previously had a disease, now have a level of immunity, then what they in turn are in effect creating an immunity to the herd. So the 30 of that 100 that have never seen the disease and are called susceptible now have little walls, call it firewalls, caused by this other 70. So for that disease to get, let's say one of the 30 gets the disease, unless all 30 happen to be exactly in the same spot at the same time, more than likely they're kind of dispersed in the 70. So then the 70 act like a wall. They stop the disease from spreading. Now that's what we're talking about when we say herd immunity. And here's the reality. The only way modern science has truly achieved herd immunity is through a vaccination. The natural ways of achieving herd immunity is basically what you call a pandemic, which is what we've seen in the past with the plague. We've seen it with SARS. We're seeing it with this SARS. We've seen it with the 1918 influenza, which killed millions of people. So a natural spread of the disease is misguided, ill-advised, and has a heavy toll in human matters, both in mortality and morbidity. So ever since the science of immunology with the first vaccination developed by Edward Jenner against smallpox, science has very effectively used that principle by immunizing, not giving them disease, but immunizing by giving them exposure that doesn't cause disease, but exposure that trains our immune system to develop antibodies to fight the disease. So if you want to condense all that into one summary statement, I would say herd immunity is best achieved, and the best way to do that is through vaccination. Every other way is huge toll, and the costs are not worth it because we have the ability, the technology to do that. So in other words, if you want SARS-CoV-2 to run rampant unchecked, then you will need at least 70% of the entire world, or at least the South, say, West River, 70% of the folks to experience the disease naturally. And then what the toll from that will be is a large amount of mortality, but also morbidity. And that's what we are trying to avoid, and that's why the race to develop the vaccine.
By that logic, then, if I understand this correctly, the development of a vaccine is also not a magic moment. It is the beginning of the next part of the journey, because a certain number of people would have to be, that vaccine has to be safe, effective, available, and accepted in the population as well. Do I understand that correctly then, too? The vaccine is the beginning of the next part of the next leg of the race.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, Lori. And another way to look at it is we have an example of vaccine that we give annually, which is the influenza, which is very similar to SARS in that it's a respiratory virus, spreads in a similar manner. And there are key differences, but from a immunization standpoint, we're doing it already with influenza, and which is why I would urge all listeners, anyone, please take the vaccination for the flu and encourage others and influence others that you know.
Let's talk about hospital capacity right now, because we are seeing all kinds of things on social media from healthcare providers, from patients, from families who are concerned about the hospital capacity, concerned about being sent to an out-of-state hospital or transferred to another hospital, diverted somewhere else, and also just having another emergency and not having healthcare workers there to tend to them if they had a stroke or a heart attack. So from a broad sense, and then we'll kind of get down to some of the basics of how we understand this, how do you speak to this concept of people saying, where is our hospital capacity, and why are people getting diverted to other facilities? What's going on?
Yes, great point. Now, this one is from a healthcare perspective. This is pretty much what we focus on daily. What we as a health system have repeatedly said is, if we can flatten the curve, which we have done so far, except for the recent past, we're seeing these rising numbers are causing real concern, because you can overwhelm the ICU capacities, and at that point, not only are you unable to take care of COVID cases, but also other, the cases that we see on a routine basis that require that kind of intensive level of care. So in a way, if we're looking at the numbers rising right now, we have the capacity at this moment, but that can change pretty quickly, and that's our biggest worry and concern.
If we have capacity at this moment, why are people getting diverted to other hospitals? How can you explain that to me?
Right. So as far as COVID cases, we have not diverted. And some of these other cases, depending on the requirement for specialties or care that could be better given somewhere else, we at Monument have not diverted COVID cases. We still have about 25 cases, and we have capacity to take care of more.
Is diverting to another place part of the plan, or is expanding, because I remember early on we were talking about what the expansion capability would be, and even the National Guard was deployed to, back in the early days. What is the plan if the numbers do not turn around at this point and there are more hospitalizations? Yeah.
Yeah, and the plan is not to divert. Two reasons why I would say that. One, our promise to the community is to provide care here. And we do have a 100-plus bed capacity in a setting that looks like a giant ward with some screens separating. They're not actually rooms, but you have beds and shared facilities for restrooms, et cetera. That plan is still in place in case there's a surge. The second reason we won't be diverting is, in a true surge situation, there's little possibility of finding hospitals that are able to take care of it, which is why we developed this plan and we built that 110, 120 bed area in the hospital, because we knew when the numbers are rising and get to a certain critical mass, We can find a place to divert folks. There won't be a hospital able to, at least in the immediate vicinity or even in the region, given that once you see that kind of sustained spread, it's not confined just to West River. It probably is the contiguous states even around us.
So when we look at the numbers, and this is the part that's confusing for people, I think, you know, should we be looking at statewide hospital capacity? Is that number useful at all? Or how are we gauging our local hospital capacity? Or is the statewide capacity enough to think about?
Yeah, I would not look at the statewide capacity. This would be very much a West River capacity. And the reason is very simple. We are quite removed from the rest of the state. You know, you can draw a 300-mile radius before you get to a decent facility that can handle large numbers of COVID cases. So we at Monument Health, we look at we have a phased plan for all of our main flagship hospital here in Rapid City, plus the other hospitals that are part of the health system, to be able to handle that numbers. And we have triggers that once we reach certain numbers, then we open up that 100-plus bed facility that we have built and start utilizing it. That's when, as you mentioned, National Guard and all these other personnel-related logistics come into play.
And you're not there yet, as I understand it.
No, we are not there yet, and we are far from it. So if you give you a good example, if you look at our numbers, West River, we had a spike a couple of months ago, and now we're seeing this huge surge, I would call it, at this point because of the large rising numbers. We had a max COVID census of, I think we topped out at 35, 36, just sub 40 range, and maybe reached 40 for a brief period, but maybe overnight. We have not reached that number. Like I said, today we're about 24, 25, and we've kind of went down to one or two or three cases for a few weeks before we started this rise again. And based on the predictive model, we expect to not see higher numbers, but you know, that's always it's a prediction. It's based on available data and analysis of what's going on in the contiguous states and how much the spread is occurring locally. What is worrying for all of us, and we're not in the crisis stage yet, is that this could potentially become a true crisis if these numbers continue to rise.
What about the health of the healthcare providers and the staff? Because that clearly you could have all the beds in the world and have no one to tend to patients in a true crisis. Tell me what you can about COVID-19 in Monument Health among staff and healthcare providers. How is that holding up? And do you have the staffing to tend to those needs, whether it's COVID-19 needs, ICU beds, or you know emergencies if you get in a car accident, for example?
Yes, excellent question. This is another area where we focused our infection prevention and infection control practices very, very resolutely and in a very concentrated manner. We have been very fortunate to, based on all of our hard work behind these practices to prevent the spread, not seen a single case where it was healthcare worker to healthcare worker within the health system. We are about 5,000 employees. We had about actual confirmed healthcare workers, 30, but none of them, COVID cases, none of them required hospitalization. But more importantly, they did not get it or give it to each other. They were all spread out in the sense that there was no cluster outbreak. These were all community acquired based on contact tracing. And, you know, we've had larger number of people either isolate because of symptoms or because of having some exposure. But as a result of these kind of measures, quickly isolating and identifying people who have been exposed, and then those that are positive, then continuing the quarantine and isolation and follow up, we have managed so far to not experience a outbreak within the health system that is either sustained or caused by poor practices. So that is one of our, we have daily meetings around this. The infection prevention team is very much involved in this. And that's kind of like our safety mantra is how can you do a good job so we don't face like rising absenteeism because of infected healthcare workers. So that's an ongoing one. And additionally, you know, what we want to do, like you correctly suggested, you know, lots of other reasons we could have a shortage or a problem with our healthcare workers is to take care of them and kind of proactively look out for their health and make sure.
Yeah. So nobody wants to declare victory and nobody wants to say the sky is falling. But setting that aside for a moment, my question to you is what can the rest of us learn from a success story like that, from the what an infection control in a hospital is doing and is finding success at, as we define it by, you know, not having clusters and things like that. And again, I don't want to overblow, you know, and say, yay, it's all victory is achieved. However, what are some of the things that you're doing that the rest of us can also do to really slow the spread of this contagion? That's my question.
Excellent question. And if you look at currently the rising cases, I'll start with that. The sky is falling part of it is truly North Dakota, South Dakota, Idaho, Wisconsin, Iowa are the top five states right now with the highest percent positivity test rates and highest daily new cases. So the reality is we can truly, based on statistics, say that there's uncontrolled and sustained community-wide transmission of COVID-19 occurring in the Midwestern states, especially the Dakotas, and here as well in the West River area as well. So that's the reality. And the question we are all asking each other is this a start of a huge surge, or is this the peak and we're going to go down? And we won't know that until that's done. So that's one. But the one thing I would say, and this is, I'm glad you asked this question, Lori, is that the one thing that really makes a difference, and there were three studies that came out, one from the University of Cambridge in the UK, one from University of Hong Kong, which is much older, in other words, that came up earlier, and then most recently a study in America where they compared the evidence for face masks. And that's the one I would take away today, is face masks save the world. And it sounds like I'm overselling it, but I can assure you that I'm actually underselling it. What we really need to all of us focus on is wear a face mask. What these studies showed is quite enlightening. So if you wore a face mask, even 50% effective face mask, in other words, a normal, ordinary cotton mask that everyone's wearing these days, not a surgical mask, because a surgical mask and an N95 are in the 80 to 95% range of efficacy. So if you took a simple face mask that's only 50% effective, if little more than 60%, just above that, about 60% of us wore it, and adherence rate was that high in the community, in the public space, you immediately bring down the transmission rate below one. And if you're in the 70 to 80%, you actually stop the disease in its tracks from spreading. So the takeaway, and this is what I would say is very important, and we have kind of, in this country at least, not developed a national policy of infection prevention practice and a hesitancy to endorse something that now, after these three studies, and you know, very, very, if you look at the graph and look at the modeling and see how this impacts face masking on top of the distancing, hand hygiene, all those other things. But the face mask additionally is what is missing in our attempts to stop this disease in its tracks. Imagine if I told you that if we practice that for the next month, we can actually stop the complete surge everywhere. But it's got to be universal. Patchwork, counties here, counties there, doing it, not doing, really is the reason why new infections arise and spread. And this is kind of in our hands. It's our ability to stop this disease is to wear that face mask in public as much as possible.
In our hands. Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Lori. Thank you.